Barry.
August 30th.
Ranting on political items. And so in 1964, Rick Geary and I discovered a group called the American Political Items Collectors, which is what it sounded like. Strange people that collected buttons, posters, bumper stickers, badges, etc., from presidential campaigns. And Alf Landon was still alive and well, Kansas's one and only presidential candidate who lost to FDR in 1936. So Rick and I drove up to Topeka to meet Alf, who was then in his 80s, and we got some campaign stuff from him. We joined the American Political Items Collectors, and our numbers were 702, 703, which is how many members there were. And this was 64. There are currently today 14,000 members of this organization. So that you can see from 1964 to 1998, the growth of this hobby is enormous. But he and I were sort of in the ground floor, so that I currently have about maybe 12, 15,000 items. And it's just, I love them, and I'm just a and I have my theme thermometer collection, as you know.
Theme thermometer.
Religious. Most of them are religious and funeral
themed. Turn
around.
Turn around.
The big one is there, but the best ones, you've seen them in the bathroom. Most of them are in the bathroom. They are old theme thermometers from the 1940s. Many of them are Jesus thermometers. A lot of them are absurd, and they make me laugh, so I collect them. And that's.
Okay. And your button collection, I think, is mentioned in the article that you gave us. That was
I mentioned a lot. Yeah. It's been on.
Charlie
Rose. I've been on a lot of TV.
Have you been on Charlie Rose?
Oh yeah, many times.
Do you have a tape?
Yeah, somewhere.
What's he like?
He was very nice to me. I liked him. That was funny. He fell for my. I came on with some of my best items. I'd done that cover piece for Art and Antiques. I think I showed you.
Yeah.
The button. He had read it. He said, "I want to get this guy on the show." This was during the Dukakis. Bush or Reagan thing, 1984. Bring on some of your best stuff. All right, so I did, and I wore a George Washington button, which looked quite old and it's quite beautiful. And I said, "Charlie, what do you think of my George Washington button? It's very rare." He said, "Oh, that's great. Did you guys didn't?" Anyway, he fell for this. There were no buttons until about 1885. This was a fake from about 1910. It was a good fake. Anyway, we had fun. It was a nice. Deal.
Nice man.
Very nice.
Yeah, he makes a nice impression.
Very nice.
Let's see.
People are fascinated. I mean, there's one button. This is my last thing on button. in the collector's business of presidential button, from Abe Lincoln to the present, the single rarest button in the single rarest election is from the year 1920, not the 1800. Lincoln stuff is of course expensive and desirable. There's lots of it. 1920. The election won by Harding. The Democrats knew they were going to lose. They nominated, it took them 63 ballots to nominate Governor James Cox of Ohio, hopeless loser. And his running mate was a young man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, still walking, vice president. They knew they were going to lose. They bothered to put out virtually nothing, campaign items. Hence, the handful of things that they did put out are worth a fortune. And if you find a button this size, 1 inch in diameter, there are about 12 of them, with Cox and Harding in their picture. I mean, Cox and Roosevelt, the Democratic candidates that year. The last one sold at an auction, that this APIC group's auction, for $48,000.
You don't have one?
I wish I do, but look in your attic for me and see
I will,
if
absolutely.
Your mother kept
them. My mother kept all of them.
$48,000 for a 1 inch button.
Unbelievable.
Okay, that's enough about it.
All right. Tell me a little bit about Fred Hetzel, because...
what a wonderful man.
Yeah, okay.
Fred Hetzel is the most wonderful man in Pittsburgh publishing history, in my opinion. Head of the University of Pittsburgh Press for years. Smart, funny, wise. He's the man that put me in, originally suggested Marcia Davenport, because the University of Pittsburgh Press was reissuing Valley Decision after many years. And... he just wanted me to do a little article on her for Pittsburgh Magazine, which I did, to help promote the book. And, well, first of all, she rarely granted interviews, but because she knew and trusted him, and she condescended to speak to me. And then we hit it off so well, and the little Pittsburgh piece was so well received that it turned into the New Yorker. Gottlieb was interested, so it turned into the New Yorker. But Fred who recently retired. You just can't say enough good about this man. What a soulful, brilliant, wonderful man, especially compared to his hideous successor, a woman named Cynthia Miller, whom I'm happy to mention as being one of the worst people in publishing in Pittsburgh, and who has turned the University of Pittsburgh Press into nothing special at all since she took over. Oh, isn't that bitchy? Load this woman. She's also the woman, Cynthia Miller. It's too bitchy a story. She was to publish Song of Haiti, my Haiti book. Told me that she would, had a firm agreement, and a year later changed her mind. Delayed the publication of this book by a year and a half. And therein lies the tale that I won't tell. So I don't like her. But Fred Hetzel is the top.
Okay, this is something.
And his son-in-law, John Schumann, John Ezra Schumann, who runs the Caliban bookstore on Craig Street, is married to Fred's daughter, is the greatest bookseller, antiquarian bookseller and book restorer in Pittsburgh. And when my stupid dog 10 years ago chewed up the first edition of Marcia Davenport's Mozart.
Oh, no.
That had been given to me, that did not belong to me, but had been given to me, loaned to me by a friend. Can you believe this? The dog chews up a first edition of Mozart from 1930, which is worth a lot of money. I was frantic. I took it to John, and he brilliantly restored it. So that's another Fred Hetzel. Fred Hetzel related to
Robert Crumb.
Robert Crumb, boy, oh, we're jumping around. What do you want to know about him?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm sort of playing a little bit of catch-up. I listened to your tape, and you mentioned Robert Crumb, and I know he was a Pittsburgh critic, and there's no comment that he was just mentioned.
What tape?
On last time we talked.
Oh, how did he come up?
I don't know how he came up. I'm trying to remember.
Well, what would you like me to say about
just, I don't know.
Characterized as a person just, or as a critic?
As a critic of the Post Gazette.
Robert Crumb is one of the best music critics, classical music critics in the United States. He's second only, in my opinion, to the guy in Boston, Richard Dyer, and no one else since Harold, what's his name, was shown at the Times. He is a brilliant, thoroughly knowledgeable critic, Robert. He pisses everybody off. There's probably no critic in the city that's more hated than he is, because he is brutally habitually mean often. Now I can say this because Robert's a very good friend of mine, has been for 25 years. Ha. So is Andre Previn. Robert was absolutely vicious to Andre Previn for all the years that he was here. I never understood it. I argued with him about it. He trashed Andre. He was picky. He was merciless to him in his reviews to Previn. Previn hates him. Previn would kill him if he had a chance. Robert made Andre's life miserable here on a week-to-week, daily basis. And I totally disagree with the stuff he wrote about Crumb. But it's a matter of opinion. Nothing musically that he ever wrote about anybody was incorrect. This is Crumb. But the opinion that comes, the judgment at the end of a review, like mine on a movie, or any other dumb critic, or brilliant critic, on anything, is a matter of opinion. And Robert didn't like his style, didn't like his conducting, didn't like his choice of British music, didn't like Lamarant, didn't like the fact that Andre wouldn't kiss his ass, didn't like a lot of things. And reflected that in his reviews, which were largely negative about Andre. But you cannot fault Robert Crumb's knowledge of music. You can fault his lack of diplomacy and other things. But anyway, he's a very good critic.
Now, will you
go? I wouldn't want to be performing under and have him review my company.
I had a cousin who was an artist, Arthur Balsam, the pianist, and he wrote some things, but I think Crone liked him. Anyway.
Well, he was a rare, he's a lucky man.
Yes. Will you be going to Andre Previn's premiere?
Yes.
When are you leaving?
Leaving September 16th. Can't wait.
Tell us San Francisco. This is okay. This is your article in Vanity Fair. Tell us about it.
Oh, briefly, the article in Vanity Fair in this issue, September 98, is a long story about Previn's opera, Streetcar Named Desire, based on the play, which premieres San Francisco, September 19th, 1998, San Francisco Opera. And it's, of course, an audacious work to try to turn the greatest American play into an opera. A lot of the critics are gunning for him, people like Robert. Of course, I am unobjective because I love Andre's music, and I think it's going to be great. I've only heard a little of the music.
And he's conducting, what, four nights?
Conducting only the first four performances.
Okay.
So Myrna and I are going out for the opening night, and I can't wait.
Will you critique it?
Yes, I might for the Post-Gazette, because nobody else would. I'm going to do an NPR, a WQED piece, and it'll probably be syndicated on NPR, and probably a follow-up in Vanity Fair. So, yeah, I'll be writing about it.
How exciting.
I mean, it's what a work, what a major, major ambitious work. I don't know or pretend to know how it's going to be received, or if, in fact, it's going to be a great work of genius. I hope for Andre's sake it is. Who knows? We'll know on September 19th.
The play certainly is,
and that's a problem for turning it into an opera, because the play is so great and people love it so much that, they have real high expectations.
Now, are any survivors of Tennessee Williams, will they be there? Does he have any relatives that are,
yeah,
or his friend?
Yeah, Brother Dakin's still alive. I know there'll be people there from the Tennessee Williams estate. Hello. But probably, other than Dake and his brother, there are no surviving relatives. No, isn't Sister Rose still in the institute?
I
she won't be there. But yeah, his Sister Rose, who the tragedy of his life, and she's still alive, but she won't be there. However, people like I asked Roddy McDowell, he's in charge of the gala the first night. Elizabeth Taylor and Roddy McDowell are in charge of the gala, and I think they said that Carl Malden and some of the people from the survivors from the film are going to be there. Not Brando, unfortunately.
No.
So there'll be some celebs running around.
Well, we're going to talk to you about after the 16th of September.
Oh, get a little update.
Absolutely. How did you... This is actually something that interested Gabby, and we agreed to this question. How did you re-enter the Post-Gazette?
Having read the In Pittsburgh article, right?
Yes,
you know the.
Yes.
At least we can skip over all that. After a long history of revolving door, in and out, controversial hirings, firings, rehirings, quittings. My in and out of the Post says like the Italian governments, you know how they change about every 6 months. With all the fighting and fussing with John Craig, the editor, over the years, he and I were very good friends and still are. And after a mere, let's just say that after the 11-year absence from the Post Gazette, the old wounds had finally healed. The old villains, from my standpoint, sub-editors, that gave me all the problems, or they would say that I gave all the problems, were gone, dead, whatever. The new regime needed a little more lively film criticism. And John and I happened to get together. Well, actually, Myrna is the one who always was the secret behind this. She and Candace, his wife, got along real well, and we met again at a party one night at Patty Burns, and talked, and I got this vibe that he gave me this and back and forth, and a few weeks later, bottom line was that I'd love to do it. I said I'd love to do it, but you know, I would never, could never work at the Post-Gazette building anymore. That was always the source of my problem. They didn't like my style, I didn't like their style, I hate newsroom, and besides, you can't smoke anymore. The smoke Nazis won't let you smoke anymore, so I could never work there. If I can do this stuff out of home and modem it to you by computer, which is, it's now 1997, that's fine. So that's how we do it. So it's been wonderful.
Okay.
But the secret reason, of course this is private, you're not going to broadcast it.
Well,
no,
you're going to be on tape. You want me to turn it off?
No,
yeah.
Well, I don't care. The real reason is that I needed to my son was having his 11th and 12th operations, and I needed the health benefits. We had not had health benefits for 11 years. Like 50% of the country, we had absolutely no health coverage of any kind from the time I left the Post-Gazette until about 10 months ago.
Ooh, that's better.
And this was a kid that needed 12 operations. And the first six or seven were when I was at the Post-Gazette, and they had the wonderful health plan and blah, blah, blah. So that was my real ulterior motive.
Is he okay?
He's wonderful.
Good.
He had the last two operations in the series, and I just took him out to Colorado to start his freshman year at University of Colorado at Boulder.
There's
that
just
was a good scenario. I could have dragged that out to 2 hours, but I made it. Okay, go ahead.
No. Leonard Bernstein is in the news again. His book, a biography, what do you think?
I haven't read that.
Okay, but it was his life.
He turned 80. His 80th birthday was last 3 days
ago.
It's hard to think of a greater figure in American music other than Gershwin. But what do you mean?
Just his life, the course that it took, and the inconsistency. What did you think of West Side Story?
West Side Story is my single favorite of all ever American musicals. Above and beyond everything Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, any of them ever wrote, West Side Story is the greatest musical. And Candide is not far behind it. And Chichester Songs and the symphonies and Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs and the Mass and the other quote-unquote serious music he wrote for, how about On the Town? This man was the most incredible, he's like Previn, very much, frankly, greater than Previn, in terms of unbelievable conductor and composer and musician, you know, jazz, symphonic, popular, musical, symphonic, and not to mention the young people's concerts and the fact that he single-handedly popularized classical music for millions and millions of people thanks to television, the best thing television ever did. You can't say enough about Bernstein. His personality was weird. I interviewed him once briefly and didn't have much sense of him and was too young. I was too young. I didn't do it right and I was too short. And he was difficult.
First time I saw him was as a pianist here in Pittsburgh.
Was it? What, playing a Gershwin or what?
Yeah, well, I don't mean, you know what, I can't tell you. I was so thrilled. My sister dragged me along because she had an extra ticket. He had on a bow tie and he was sort of the sophisticated, not that we were sophisticated, but you know, we were exposed to symphony and opera. He was that version of Frank Sinatra.
Oh yeah, that's a good comparison. He even looks a little like
skinny
and
bow tie and
he was the Frank Sinatra.
Yes, the classical.
That's a good analogy.
Okay, I have to do this because I can't let it go. Your mother was secretary to Miss Manna when he was at the Nuremberg trials, was he not?
Yep.
Okay.
Miss Manna, on a local level, one of the greatest, most colorful figures in Allegheny.
What's his name?
Justice Michael A. Musmanna, M-U-S.
One of the most egocentric, right?
Oh,
M-U-S.
His nephew Neil is now a judge.
His clothes, his tie.
Oh, yeah, flamboyant.
I'm not a Pittsburgh. I have to write this down. He was a judge?
He was. Started out as a famous lawyer locally. He was with Clarence Darrow. He argued the Sacco and Vanzetti case. He was a brilliant, great lawyer and fabulous social democrat liberal in the 20s and 30s. Defended Sacco and Vanzetti to the death, literally. He debated Darrow on the subject of does God exist in a famous debate.
The Lane Bryant. The Bryant.
The Inherit the Wind.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. He wrote a brilliant book on the Pennsylvania coal police called Black Fury that was turned into a movie, wonderful movie with Paul Muni. He was a wonderful, interesting man. He went to war. He was in the Navy. He was a captain. And subsequently became the military governor of Italy, southern Italy, Sicily, and a judge at the Nuremberg War Trial. Wrote several books on that, wrote what was considered the definitive book called 10 Days to Die on the Death of Hitler, establishing that Hitler was indeed dead at a time when lots of people believed that he had escaped. By now, this is his fifth or sixth book. My mother had worked for the Italian law firm of Albo, Cantanzara, Conflenti, Musmanna, and all these good big Italian Democratic lawyers, David Lawrence in the 20s, 30s. David Lawrence becomes the big Democratic power, Miss Mantle gets elected at that point, just I think the common pleas. My mother was his secretary. Then he was elected to the Supreme Court, and she was his private legal secretary. And personally typed his later books across the street from the courthouse. At this point, which was 1950, Miss Mantle turns into something of a monster. Instead of just being egocentric and flamboyant, he becomes a McCarthy, sort of violent anti-communist, red baiter, red hunter, tracks down all the local, Steve Nelson, the Pittsburgh Communist Party, persecutes them, becomes really pretty terrible. She, a couple of years later, quit, not because of that, but because she had me, 1948, but always had a close relationship with him, and he would write her these incredible, I think I told you, they had this great discussion. He said one day that she was mouthy like me, and he told her something peremptory. She who had kept all of it, she's the one that ran his life properly and half wrote some of his legal opinion. And he criticized her unfairly someday, I forget about what, and she snapped back at him that he was completely wrong and didn't know he was on. And he said, "Claire, when I speak, it does not require an answer." And she said, "Oh, when you speak, let no dog bark."
That's marvelous.
This is my mother, and this is Miss Mantle, and she quit soon after that, fussing with him. But they always communicated, they had a close relationship, and he was wonderful to me and my brother and sister. He wrote us letters in college, you know, recommendations to help get us. He was a lovely man personally. He only hadn't taken that turn to the right, as a lot of Democrats did in those days. But for Pittsburgh standpoint, he's like this colleague, like the Cyril Weck plus 1,000 of the day. Everything he did was on the front page, you know.
Gabby wanted to know, how many copies of a book have to be sold before there's a profit? At what point do you...
Yeah, well, it's, of course, totally relevant to the amount of the advance. If they only give you 10,000 for the advance, then they only have to sell maybe a couple thousand books. If they give you 100,000, then they have to sell maybe 30,000 books. They give you 300,000, you know, you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And also the cost of production, if it has a lot of photos, as all my books do, it increases it. So to give you an example, Louise Brooks, I don't hesitate to tell people financially, I got $50,000 for Louise to write a commission. That was the advance. It sounded like a lot of money in 1986. It took me 4 years to write it, so divide 4 into 50,000, and I got, well, minus the agents, 10%, minus the IRS, 30%, and I got, you know, the average of about less than 10,000 a year to live on, right? Okay. But that was a good deal for them, because the book did ultimately do very well and sold something like 40,000. So they made, and that was in the U.S., and then they sold lots of foreign editions, so that was all gravy, right? So that did real well.
At what point do you get percentages?
Well, you get royalties as soon as the sales equal your advance.
Okay.
However long that takes. And, but then for Garbo, that's a long story, but the bottom line is that I got pretty significantly greater amount of money, and it did not as well proportionately in sales, so that I've basically not really gotten much royalty on that, and they broke even on it but didn't do real well. So does that sort of explain
it? Mm-hmm. What about bestsellers? How does that all happen?
Same way, except that of course it's all self-fulfilled prophecy. If you're Danielle Steele or Clancy or Robert John Grisham, then whatever you write is going to be a bestseller, because the publisher is going to put out 500,000 of them and have a stack of them at every book counter, and so it guarantees that they'll sell. You know,
so the publisher goes for the name ultimately.
But that name gets a much larger advance.
Precisely, the name. He'll get $2 million for his next book based on a page and a half proposal. And they won't have any idea whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Neither will he.
Absolutely.
Make.
Okay,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I have a question, but it can wait.
If it's not apparent, is it pertaining to this?
It pertains to books. You finish and be my man.
How much when you read the reviews, you know, the New York Times book review,
mm-hmm.
and then you hit the bestseller list first, you know, for the hardback, and then since I think I certainly have become very cynical. How does this happen? How does your book get reviewed over somebody else's? I mean, there are so many books.
Can't possibly do them all.
Okay, so, and so many publishers, I'm sure the public have their own clout. How do you get reviewed by the New York Times? I mean, you got an excellent review. That's how your name came to me, by Audrey Hepburn's review.
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is that it's an extremely arbitrary process, and that it's up entirely to the whim of the people at the New York Times Book Review. Now, that's the main operative thing. In other words, they review whatever the hell they want to review. Now, then within the industry and the history, there's this semi-unofficial criteria of things like, as mentioned about Knopf, the publisher is a major thing. And it's not fair that it's this way, but it is that. For instance, Knopf, luckily for me, is considered the top of the line American publisher. It's the best. Both fiction and especially nonfiction over the years, and puts out far fewer titles than the other companies, which means that almost any and almost every Knopf book is going to be reviewed in the New York Times.
So you're in that elite hierarchy.
Yes, well, the publisher is.
Okay, but then
and
you...
So I get the benefit of that by, unless it's like The History of the Pencil, which came out the same year that my Louise... It's going to get... Actually, that did get a review, too. I mean, but you get the idea. Most Knopf books are going to be reviewed just because they're Knopf books. Whereas, you know, if it's Schmidlap Publishing in, you know, Poughkeepsie, that poor guy's book, even though it may be 10 times better than mine, is probably not even going to be seen. They'll send it to the New York Times and they'll look at it and they'll deposit it in the circuit. You know, it'll be difficult for him to get reviewed. And in between are, let's say, Doubleday, which is a good middle-of-the-line publisher, but not the best, and certainly not the worst, but they've got 300 titles a year. So whoever at the Times, they get them all, and they're the daily, you know, they have to take wheelbarrows full to get them into the building every day. Whoever goes through, maybe this, maybe that, maybe that, and it's a crapshoot.
Okay, and how do you get to be a reviewer of the book?
That's another complex thing. Basically, by cronyism. Now, they have 4 regular reviewers at the Daily. This is an interesting thing about the New York Times. They have the daily book reviews that appear in the Daily Times, the Monday through Saturday, are the famous names that you know, Machiko Kakutani, you know what her name, and used to be Frank Rich. The 3 or 4 of them that you see regularly.
I can't think of their names.
I can't either, but you know, Anthony Huzitz with a hyphenated... And then those are 4 regular people.
Okay.
You can count on them, at least they're regular and they have a track record and they have their personalities, what kind of books they do or don't. The Sunday section, the New York Times Sunday Book Review, which is more important in terms of its impact, though certainly not in terms of its quality, is the real cronyism crapshoot thing of whoever they hand out those books to other authors. So that depending on competence of the author, I mean, who's doing the review, the vindictiveness or the magnanimity, the objectiveness or the prejudices, you can get anybody doing great things or great damage to your book for reasons that you will never understand. And I've had both the good and the bad. And at the bottom line is, I have very little respect for the New York Times Sunday Book Review section. Even it is the most important thing in the country for authors. It comes out, and it is the most arbitrary. And I don't like it, and I don't like the way they run it. And not just because of a couple of things involving me, but because of friends of mine's book. It is not a fair system, it's not a rational system, not a good system. But that doesn't change the fact that it's the single most important thing for an author in this country is to get a favorable review of that.
We get posted on every bulletin board, every bookstore.
Yep, you get a good one in that,
that
section, and you got it.
And that wonderful page in the back where they review and they make suggestions, do you think that has authenticity? Because it seems to me it does.
Well, it has huge impact. What do you mean authenticity?
Well, at the very end, they make suggestions that are sometimes not even on the bestseller list. They just...
Yeah, they recommend. It's all opinion,
okay.
Darling. It's like my movie review. And frequently they're good, often justified, and sometimes they're not. And they're no more. The Post Gazette does the same thing. So does the Cleveland Dealer. So does the Baltimore Sun. It just so happens that the New York Times one is the one that everybody pays attention to. And whether it's the selections are truly meritorious or not, that's an arbitrary thing. It, sometimes they are. Maybe usually they are. But often they're not. Often, you know, the guy's got a friend in the, you know, he writes, you know, oh, my pal is writing. There's all sorts of cronyism.
So, Barry, you've been with the media, the print media, for many, many years, and with the newspaper media. Now we're getting into doing, there's a lot of investigative reporting. In fact, there's a case mentioned in your article where there was some whitewashing. But I'm only referring to that because we're going to have that as a backup, you know, as print for our interview. There are so many investigative reporting shows now. There are also, since I've started out my questions asking you about the paper, the media print, we now know at the Boston Globe someone has been dismissed. We know that even the New Republic, which was the elite of elite, what...
In that Vanity Fair with my Previn article, it's a great article on Stephen Glass,
right.
New Republic, the one
okay.
that faked 26th
Street. What's happened? CNN, this is naturally the...
Yeah, the CNN.
Okay, with
the thing
Peter
on the,
Arnett, the only one that was spared. What
The Vietnam
changed?
Bombing killed